Here we are. It's that time. Hooray. Arthur Schwartz, the food mensch. Here, live, now, in person.
You sound so enthusiastic.
Well, it's you.
It's a new year. If you're Jewish, it's a new year. Next week, it's a two-day holiday celebrating the new year, but also the time of year when God decides whether you were a good boy or a bad boy, good girl or a bad girl. I'm just oversimplifying, of course. And so it's a holy time starting the first evening of Rosh Hashanah and continuing for 10 days to a holiday called, well, it's a holy day, called Yom Kippur, or Yom Kippur, as we used to say when I was a kid. You know, the pronunciation of Jewish holidays, Hebrew, etc., has changed since I was a boy. For one thing, the State of Israel only existed for a year when I was born, and it took a little while for the Sephardic pronounced Hebrew that they were speaking in Israel got to the U.S. So I remember this vividly. There was a generational divide between my younger cousins and me, because I learned how to say the prayers with the Ashkenazi pronunciation, the Eastern European pronunciation, and they were learning the same thing, but with the Sephardic, so it was different. Anyway, my grandfather didn't care. He just proceeded with his Ashkenazi, and if they pronounced something wrong, he ignored it. He would think it was wrong. Anyway, Jewish New Year is a great holiday. I mean, and there are no, by the way, no food restrictions like there are in Passover, where you're not allowed to have anything fermented, including and namely flour. So you can make almost anything. I mean, of course, if you're kosher, it's got to be kosher. A dish that I adore, but I don't allow myself, even though it's a pretty easy thing to do, I make only for New Year. And it's a modernized dish created by a young couple who wrote a book called The Gefilte Manifesto. I love the name. And this recipe caught my attention and the attention of maybe hundreds of thousands of people. I looked this morning, and it's in various forms, not all of them like the original form, all over the internet, as crispy chicken with tzimis. Now, the reason I don't allow myself this is I, in the days when I was taking my, checking my blood sugar, I realized that this dish, because of the sweetness and the prunes, in fact, I ended up testing prunes all on their own, are not great for my blood sugar. So there are ways to mollify, is that the word? I don't know. To lessen the impact of this sweet dish. But the point is to be sweet, because on Rosh Hashanah, we eat sweet things. We Jews are very superstitious. We eat sweet things to ensure a sweet year. This dish has a double whammy, or I should say a double superstition. It also has carrots cut into rounds, which in Jewish food symbolism means money, or at least hope for the future. Interestingly, it's used in Chinese culture in exactly the same way. Cut carrots as into coins, and it represents money. Sounds good. Gold. So this dish combines chicken with what we call tzimis. Now, the word tzimis is used generally to mean a fuss. Don't make such a tzimis, your grandmother might say. But tzimis is a number of different things, and in the end, not as fussy as the name sounds. My grandmother and my mother made two different kinds of tzimis. We had sweet potato tzimis, which was made with sweet potatoes and prunes and a piece of flanken or other meat, usually flanken. and cooked, and I guess with honey as well. Anyway, it ended up being sweet and sour meat cooked with sweet potatoes, sort of what could be bad. It's the Jewish version of candied sweet potatoes. The other tzimmis was strictly carrots. I didn't like this tzimmis all that much, but my father did, so my mother made it. But it was carrots cut into rounds and then cooked also with a piece of meat and some honey. And at the end, and water. And at the end, my mother actually thickened it with cornstarch. So I didn't like, even though I can eat tons of Chinese food with cornstarch gravy or sauce, this one bothered me. So anyway, this tzimmis is just carrots, prunes, and onion. I've seen some recipes for this dish, more or less, made also with sweet potato. And you know you could do that. You could cut up the sweet potato into cubes and toss it in with the carrots. And they cook it about the same time. And so it all comes out okay. So this starts out, as I said, with chicken. Now, one of the things I love about this dish is that you can make it all in one pan. And so less work for Arthur to clean later. So I use a 10-inch... black cast iron skillet, good old black iron skillet. You want to brown the chicken first. So I use this 10-inch skillet, and I usually can fit in 6 medium-sized chicken thighs, which is just about right for this. If you want, you can use breasts. We don't care for breasts very much. You could use a whole chicken cut up into pieces. You could use the thigh drumstick joint, in which case you're only going to be able to fit 4 in a 10-inch skillet. If I use my thighs, I can fit 6 into a skillet. So first thing is to brown the chicken. It takes about 7 or 8 minutes, skin side down, in a little bit of oil. You can start with a little bit of oil. Another way to cook the chicken this way, by the way, is I do it every once in a blue moon. You put the chicken in a cold pan and put it over medium-high heat, and you'll render out some of the fat from the skin right away, and then you can lower the heat a little bit. And starting in a cold pan, it's going to take more than 8 minutes, but you're going to get a nice amount of chicken fat in there. So what you want to do is also, while you're browning the chicken, you can make the glaze. Let's call it the glaze. In the end, it's the thing that's going to really flavor everything, as well as make the chicken crispy in the end. So I would say here's your glaze would be at least 2, if not 3 tablespoons of freshly grated ginger root. 3 tablespoons of honey, and use a mild honey. The go-to honey for Jews, although in the old days, was golden blossom honey, which is a very nice, mild orange blossom honey. So 3 tablespoons of ginger, 3 tablespoons of honey, a good tablespoon of vegetable oil, any one you like, use. A couple teaspoons of salt. And I don't usually put lemon zest in my dish here because it doesn't really have much flavor. And in fact, I just made something the other day using quite a lot of lemon zest, and I could not tell it was even there. And I was talking to a friend of mine who's a baker, and I said to her, have you noticed that we don't get much flavor out of lemon zest these days? And she said, absolutely, I hardly ever use it these days. Now, I realized this years ago when I was making a lot of Neapolitan pastry, and those pastries always contain grated lemon zest, grated orange zest. And, you know, except for the year that I was able to buy Amalfi lemons at Whole Foods, I have yet to taste this lemon zest. So I just leave it out. So I'm going to rehash. The glaze is so important. 3 tablespoons of grated ginger, 3 tablespoons of honey, 2 tablespoons, well, a tablespoon of vegetable oil, a teaspoon of salt, or 2 teaspoons of salt, really. It depends on your salt take. And I don't put hot pepper in, but sometimes I do. A quarter of a teaspoon, a half a teaspoon of hot red pepper flakes. If you like hot red pepper flakes, this is the place to put them. And mix that all up. And when your chicken, the skin, has browned, remove it from the pan, put it in a bowl, and pour over this glaze. Meantime, sauté in the same pan that you browned the chicken, which should have a lot of fat in it by now, sauté a nice-sized onion, at least 6-ounce onion, which is a 3-to-a-pound onion, sliced. Sauté that until it wilts a little bit. Then put in your carrots, at least 5-6 carrots cut into half-inch rounds, and put that in the pan and sauté those for 5 minutes. So now you have onion and carrot in the pan. I don't add my prune until the end. And here's why. I don't want it to fall apart altogether. And I actually, the first time I made this, or maybe the second time I made this, I decided what I needed was not pitted prunes, which are easy to find in the supermarket, but prunes still with their pits, which is what my grandmother always used to make her simises, and they were sour. I have shopped all over, and if they don't exist in Brooklyn, they're going to be really hard to find anywhere else. So, and there is one store, one Middle Eastern store on Atlantic Avenue, Yemenite store, or I should say Yemeni store, and he claims to have prunes with pits. But they're not the same. I don't know what they are. They're not for this dish. So you're going to have to use pitted prunes. And instead of chopping them, I with the scissors, I cut them into 2 or 3 pieces each. That's as small as you really need to get them. And you need about, I would say, 8 ounces of pitted prunes cut up like that. So after you've sautéed the onion, and then you put in the carrot and sauté that for 5 minutes, you then can put in the pitted prunes cut up, and about 3/4 cup of water with which you're going to scrape the bottom of the pan to get up any brown bits from the chicken and the onion. And then put the chicken, now glazed with this ginger honey glaze, put it on top of the vegetable mixture, and whatever juices are left in that bowl, drizzle them over your chicken in the pan, and put the pan in a 400-degree oven for about 25-30 minutes until the carrots are tender, the chicken is done. It should be done in 30-35 minutes. And it really looks great in the pan, a black pan with this glazed chicken and orange rounds, very, very attractive. And so you can bring the whole thing to the table, which I have done. By the way, I have a enormous, enormous black iron skillet. I once made this for a party. It's a great party dish. Make it all ahead. Just, you know, stick it in the oven at the last minute, well, 45 minutes before you go to eat it. And then you can bring the whole thing to the table. And my pan held enough, I think, for like 8 people. But a pan full, a 10-inch skillet, we're talking 4 to 6 people. I think, you know, if you get large chicken thighs, you're not going to fit more than 4 or 5 in the pan. If they're smaller, you can get 6 in there. You know, you decide. So that's really my main course for a Rosh Hashanah, a New Year's dinner. Got to say, as everything has changed since I was a boy, when I was a boy, we did not dunk apples in honey, at least not in my family or any of the families I knew. We all dunked challah bread, challah, in our honey. And that's another superstitious thing, is to ensure a sweet year. My mother actually had a special dish for the honey for Rosh Hashanah, which I still have, and I guess I'll use this year. The other thing is most families these days, in the old days too, make brisket for Rosh Hashanah. I mean, that was always, brisket was always the go-to, let's call it a party dish, you know, big family feast dish. And for one thing, a brisket serves a lot of people. For another thing, it's an expensive cut of meat, so it shows, you know, you've arrived. If you can serve a brisket, you've arrived. But I don't really care for it anymore so much. And it's very time-consuming to make a good brisket. Now, I've told this story many, many times, but my mother went through many phases of brisket in her life. And I always joke about the one that she made with Harvey's Bristol cream. Actually, it works. My grandmother, my paternal grandmother, made her brisket with ketchup. And so it was more of a Yankee pot roast, I would say, than a Jewish brisket. But in the end, my mother went back to what her mother did, my grandmother did, which is make a big bed of onions in a roasting pan. I mean, a lot of onions. If you've got a 6-pound brisket, you may want to have 4 pounds of onions in the pan. Sliced, just scatter them on the bottom. I sometimes put carrot in, and I sometimes don't. If I'm not making carrots anywhere else in the meal, I very well may put some carrots in. And you salt and pepper the meat very well. You don't need to brown it. Put it on top of the onions and carrot. If you like, you can put a few bay leaves underneath the brisket. Cover the whole thing in the roasting pan with foil, unless you have a roasting pan like my grandmother did, in which I still have, but it's in the storage room. And it's a covered roasting pan. So cover the pan, and then you put it in a 275 to 300 degree oven for hours, at least 4 hours. And you're going to get a pretty tender piece of meat. The meat itself and the onions will create the juices that it needs to have a moist roasting. And when it's done, it should be fork tender, but not falling apart yet. And you take it out. You take out the roast. Well, you don't have to take. Well, take out the roast and slice it after it cools down to, you know, warm temperature. Slice it and then put it back in the pan in the conformation it was originally. And when you go to reheat, now you can put it in the refrigerator overnight. It's already cooked. The next day, however, you want to put it in a hot oven without the foil on top, and the brisket will brown to a nice color, and some of the juices will evaporate, which is good. And there you go. And it's already sliced, and the onions become the gravy. We, when it wasn't Rosh Hashanah, we would eat this with kasha, and then put the onions from the roast on top of the kasha. I still crave that from time to time. But the other thing to do is, this, by the way, was made this way. I made the best brisket of my life. Thank God it was Martha Stewart. When I did them, I think this is online. There's a video of me on Martha Stewart having made this sensational brisket. We all swooned over the brisket. But you know what? Besides that it's a good cooking method, it was a really good brisket from a really, really good butcher. A commercial. Then, in those days, just a commercial butcher. Nowadays, DeBraga, 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 actually will deliver to you. Well, they sell retail, and they will deliver. They'll deliver almost anywhere for $10. So it's worth it. And it's great meat, but you're going to pay a great price for the great meat. God, I don't even know what a whole brisket costs, but I'm sure it's several hundred dollars. So for me, the chicken for Rosh Hashanah is a better idea. Both of them deserve what I call the best recipe in my Jewish cookbook, which is, by the way, it's called Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking, Yiddish Recipes Revisited. I say Yiddish because they're Eastern European recipes for the most part. They're my childhood recipes, and they're recipes that you could used to be able to find in kosher restaurants, but updated somewhat. By the way, you know, whenever somebody tells me it's unhealthy, terrible food, I guide them to my cookbook because it's not. And it deserves some connoisseurship as well. Anyway, the thing that I like to eat with this is potato kugel. Kugel is a Yiddish word for pudding, more or less. And there's most people know about noodle kugel, which is very popular these days, sweet noodle kugel. I don't ever make sweet noodle kugel. But that's not true. I do make it from time to time. But a dairy kugel with cheese in it and butter. But potato kugel is grated potatoes with some starch. I use matzo meal. Eggs, a lot of eggs, salt, pepper, and not much else. I put, if I have chicken fat, I put chicken fat in my 9x13-inch pan, and that'll suffice. You can use vegetable oil as well. And that recipe is in my Jewish book. I believe it's three. By the way, use russet potatoes, which have the right kind of starch for this. Yukon Gold, other all-purpose potatoes don't work as well as russets. Peel them. Russets are baking potatoes. So they don't have to be from Idaho, but the variety is called russet. And they are sold in the supermarket as russet. I don't buy little ones because it's too many to peel, but they do come small. So you peel the potatoes, and you grate them on the coarse side. Depends. I use the food processor, to be honest with you. I grate them in the food processor, but I don't grate them. I use the steel blade. And I learned how to do this literally from my grandmother, who decided she had to master the food processor before she died, and she did. So you grate them, and then you squeeze out, by putting the potatoes in a strainer and using a rubber spatula, you squeeze out any excess moisture. Now, to prevent them from turning black or red, pink, I use, like my grandmother did, in fact the same one, a silver plate spoon in the bowl with the potatoes. The tartrates on the surface of a tarnished silver spoon prevent the potatoes from turning color. Another possibility is you could just put a squeeze of lemon juice in, just a little bit. You don't want to taste the lemon in the end. Another thing is you can grate the onions first. And for 3 pounds of potatoes, I would use two nice-sized onions. And I do the same thing with them in the food processor, not until they're pureed, but until they're finely chopped. Put them in a bowl, then put the drained grated potatoes in the bowl with the onion, and the acidity of the onion helps keep the potato white. And put it all in there, beat in the eggs, beat in matzo meal. I'm forgetting how much, but it's not a whole lot. And then put your melted shortening, meaning chicken fat, or some oil in your 13x9-inch pan. And when you pour in the batter for the potato kugel, the oil or the schmaltz will pool in the corners. So push down the corners of the potato mixture itself and let that fat, whatever it is, get onto the surface of the potato kugel. And to ensure that the top comes out crisp, I also drizzle, but only drizzle, the top with some oil or schmaltz, melted schmaltz, of course. And that gets baked for, I don't know, at least at 350, 375, for at least an hour. And this is another thing that heats extremely well. In fact, it even heats up nicely in the microwave. My grandmother didn't have a microwave, so she didn't do that, but she did reheat it. And we liked it reheated because the edges get even crispier. And many of us like the crispy edge pieces as opposed to some of the family like the middle. We all got along together because some of us like the middle without the crust and some of us like the crusty pieces. Another thing I had a laugh about when I was thinking about this is that I have a cousin. It was actually my mother's first cousin, Danny, who I called Uncle, Uncle Danny. Uncle Danny didn't eat egg whites. I don't know why. But he did love egg yolks. So on Passover, when one of the traditional first courses is cold salt water with chopped eggs in it, my grandmother would, in deference to her son and her nephew, she would separate egg yolks and egg whites so that my uncle only got the yolks and my Uncle Danny only got the whites. Those were the days. Anyway, the other thing I came to mind when I was running through my brain, this chicken with tzimis and the honey. Honey's a big deal on Rosh Hashanah. But one of our favorite things is something I don't see anybody making anymore, teglach. Teglach are identical to Neapolitan struffoli. They are little balls of dough that are fried. And then, in the case of teglach, mixed with honey syrup and patted out on a board. You moisten the board with sweet wine just so that it didn't stick. And it stuck anyway. And you pat down the teglach, which is the fried balls, mixed with the honey, and you patted it out into a flat thing. And then my grandmother would sprinkle it with ginger powder, with ground ginger. Now, it's funny that ginger became a main flavoring in Eastern European cooking. It doesn't grow in Eastern Europe. My grandmother only used ground powdered ginger, unlike my chicken, crispy chicken with tzimis, which uses fresh ginger, I think unheard of back in the day. But she did put powdered ginger on top, and that was the main flavoring. Oh, yes. In her honey syrup, she had black pepper. So it was a spicy sweet. It was these dough balls embedded in a peppery, gingery honey. And the honey, by the way, you had to cook the balls in the honey for a while to get it to, and my grandmother just eyeballed this, to get it to the candy stage. And it was very hot. So I could just see her hands popping up and down because you could barely touch it. It was so hot. But anyway, I don't know where you can find teglach even anymore. But you can wait until Christmas and get Neapolitan struffoli. They don't have the ginger in it. It often has candied fruit in it. But it's the same thing, exactly. Anyway, I'm looking forward to Rosh Hashanah.
Sounds
it's always a fresh start, you know. For me, it's a new year in September. I like that.
We always called it fresh start, back to school, new year.
Exactly.
Yep.
New school supplies.
And it always made sense. So, it was one of those, just always made sense. So.
Okay. So,
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to everybody.
And thank you.
Healthy New Year.
Oh, that too. And sweet New Year.
And a prosperous New Year, if that's important.
This has been Arthur Schwartz, the Food Mensch, on Robinhood Radio.